Hello and welcome to MOAS. In this episode, we're looking at human trafficking and the world that surrounds it, both in Libya and Niger. We'll be drawing perspectives from journalists, academics, and international organizations on the ground. But before we launch into the discussion, let's break down the differences between human trafficking and smuggling. Both are often used interchangeably, but are, in fact, different. Human trafficking is when people are transported illegally from one country to another under threats or actual force. Victims can end up being used for forced labor or prostitution, for example. With people smuggling, the people involved enter an agreement with a smuggler to make a journey illegally in return for money, and are therefore complicit in the movement. Narciso Contreras is a freelance photojournalist, and he's been investigating Libya's status as a transit country for migrants. With the help of a network of militias, he's discovered that the label only scratches the surface of the situation on the ground.
We were told from the beginning of the crisis that Libya, even from Gaddafi's times, Libya has been this getaway for migrants attempting to reach Europe by sea. This is partially true, and actually the first hypothesis that I worked on this project was based on the official statement of Libya as a transit destination for migrants, and migrants that were trapped in the middle of a tribal conflict. So these two lines of the hypothesis were essential to start documenting on the ground this situation. But then the project unfolded by the time that I work during the 4 months of photographing different places in Libya to a different hypothesis by collecting testimonies, doing interviews, and visiting different, especially detention centers, that we realized the dimension of the crisis, the real dimension of the crisis. So part of the crisis, part of what describes the crisis and in terms of migration in Libya, is that Libya is a transit destination for a large number of migrants trying to reach Europe by the sea. But not also is a transit destination. Libya became a trafficking market where a large number of migrants, not just the ones that try to reach Europe, but the ones that go to Libya for working purposes, get trapped in a cycle of trafficking and slavery, and it evolves from kidnapping, from extortion, from forced labor, and so on. Different aspects of this situation. And we could document both sides of these two aspects of the crisis. This is why, by spending enough time, we could get a glimpse of the dimension of this crisis. But just a glimpse. It was not, even the project doesn't describe the complexity of this crisis or this situation, but just gives a clue about it. And we were shocked by doing it. We were shocked by collecting all this information.
You've spoken to victims of trafficking, but what do they tell you about their experiences?
Since back in 2014, I did interview with migrants in a detention center at the outskirts of Misrata. They were describing situations. One of them, for instance, was an Eritrean one, pushing to get to Europe, following his wife. At that time, he was one among the migrants that told me the militias in charge, the people in charge at the detention centers were asking for ransom to release him. If I remember correctly, at that time, the amount of money asked for him was around 300, 400 euros. And that was the first the first testimony inside detention centers. And then in the south, I met with migrants that were queuing for work at one of these spots on the streets at the, in the migrant settlements, in the poor neighborhoods, at the outskirts of the city, even in the city center where they where the migrants queued for jobs. And many of these guys were telling me about how different armed groups arrive, picking up migrants and taking them to different working locations and forcing them to work without any payment, you know? And not just being forced to work, but also they were submitted to daily beatings and other kind of situations. So since then, the first testimonies were pulling me to follow the topic. But then back in 2016, when we started properly this project, I had a chance to interview two migrants that were working for free. One of them for the director of a detention center in Zawiya, and the second one was one among three that were working for a militia commander in Surman. I had a chance to interview them. They were basically working as slaves for these two characters. One of these guys told me that from the beginning, the story how he left for his hometown, coming to Libya, going to Libya, then paid for a smuggler to be taken to Europe. And when he reached a location in the north, a militia group taken them to another place, and they were sold to a third group. And this process took like over 2 to 3 months. And then he ended up in a detention center. After that, he found himself working for this militia commander, paying for his release during 7 months. And these were testimonies that usually you could find tracking the line of smuggling or trafficking is more difficult. But trafficking actually happens inside detention centers because militias or the groups in charge are the ones that by distributing also sell the migrants to other groups by for ransom purposes.
Can you describe what it was like in the detention centers you visited?
Well, almost anything you see inside detention centers are horrendous experiences, from the overcrowding places, a single room of 10 or 15 square meters, whatever dimension is a room, is just a packet of people. There is not space for anyone to lie on the floor. Everyone has to sit in a very, very small area without the right to stand up. In this small place, without food, without medication. When I saw the guards, the militia guys beating up a female migrant was queuing for food, because they complain, you know, when they get the chance, they complain, they keep complaining all the time, and guards try to keep them calm by threatening them or beating them up. And I saw this situation. Immediately, there was a doctor at the place. The doctor screamed to the guard saying that stop beating the girl because there were two foreigner or to visitors at the place, so just to stop doing this, no? I think the most shocking was when I met this group of mentally ill female migrants in this former zoo. They were inside cages, of these former cages of the zoo, completely isolated. And they were in the place for years, 2 years at least, what I documented for one of these women. And the living conditions of these mentally ill migrants were terrible. They were sleeping in a very dirty mattress, surrounded by excrement, in a very bad smell, and the living conditions for the mentally ill group of female migrants that I met, that was very very shocking, especially since I think they were very representative, I think, for the worst that being a human being you can face, you can find out in the most difficult situations, no? Being a migrant, being illegal, being African, being woman, is like being in a position of the most vulnerable, the end of the road, no? I think when I met this group of women, there was nothing else to witness, no? And that was the worst that I could see along the project.
Libya's illicit economy is well documented, and human trafficking and smuggling now make up a key part of it. It's a profitable industry, allowing groups to stake a claim in post-Gaddafi Libya. Tuesday Ritano is Deputy Director for the Global Initiative. She says that the industry is deeply rooted in Libya's future. It's just one of the competing interests ensuring the country remains unstable.
We looked at dynamics both in the northwestern corner, which is where all the departures have taken place. It's sort of a 100-kilometer stretch of the coastline west of Tripoli, where 99% of the departures have taken place. But this is really micro politics of Libya, and I think even we hadn't expected how detailed and you had to be, how granular in understanding the dynamics. I mean, our report goes almost city by city, first, you know, looking at the dynamics on three or four coastal cities, and then just moving 50 to 100 kilometers south, the next hub, which is the staging point for the coast, and how intertwined the different networks in play are. So, you know, we found human smuggling is now probably the second largest economic generator across Libya after fuel smuggling, that it is deeply interwoven into the politics of the competing central states on the east and the west, that it is engaging with a number of very traditionally marginalized actors in Libya who are playing their own role in the smuggling industry for political leverage. It took us a while to finish because we found new developments every week. Libya's politics is volatile. And at the same time, Libya is part of a broader system across the Greater Sahel and the Horn of Africa.
Human trafficking is a major industry today. But how big was it before the revolution?
Libya and Algeria, as the two big hydrocarbon economies in Africa, have always drawn migrants to them to work. I mean, the IOM estimates of the migrant stock from sub-Saharan Africa in the country prior to the revolution was some 600,000 people who were living and working and participating in the Libyan economy, perhaps with no greater intention to go onwards from there. But nonetheless, the appeal of the sea route and the call of Europe has been consistent over decades in Europe. I mean, before Gaddafi's fall, he was negotiating with the Italian government for €6 billion annually in support to prevent rising rates of irregular migration. So I think a lot of people see this as a long-standing and cyclical trend. But from our analysis, it wasn't as profitable ever as it is now. So a colleague of mine released a report on illicit trafficking and Libya's transition back in 2013. And at that point, migrants were the bottom of the hierarchy, whereas illicit drugs, pharmaceuticals, fuel smuggling, arms smuggling were much higher. But I would say that balance has changed very much now. Human smuggling has never been so profitable in Libya as it is at the moment.
Any estimates on its current value?
You can estimate. I mean, what we do in our analysis is track the prices that people are paying. What has made that more complicated is that the pricing structures have changed and there are a number of different groups now issuing. But essentially, you can do the maths. Back in 2015, we issued an estimate that said it was a $323 million industry in Libya in 2015-16. At this point now, actually, the costs on a boat have fallen, but the number of people traveling have increased. And there has become a secondary trade building up around extortion of migrants in Libya. Though this also existed, it's growing in its practice. So now I would say, you know, it's certainly over half a billion.
When you talk about the illicit economy, you say that trafficking is one point of a perverse resource triangle. What is that? What are the other two points and how do they work together?
I think what we were very struck by in our analysis is that in the post-revolutionary period in Libya, how the incentive systems were so structured to orient people towards external interests, often which were counter to the consolidation of the central state, rather than internal interests, domestic interests, and on sort of a creating or recreating a coherent single Libyan state. Basically, I think it's exactly at the point where the post-conflict period, everybody should be looking towards the one unified Libya. In actual fact, there was nothing encouraging that. The first step, oddly enough, and so we identified this as the perverse resource triangle. And the first in this triangle was almost the most extraordinary in that it was a highly militarized culture. There were militia groups who had an enormous influence over the political process. And the state was paying those militias. So because there was no central state security organ by design under the Gaddafi regime, the transitional state was left negotiating with individual militia groups to try and get them to keep the peace. Now, essentially, the militia groups, the noisier and more violent they were, the more they were paid for peacekeeping. So interestingly enough, none of these militia groups had any incentive of being well-behaved and playing the game. It was far better for them to be dissonant and difficult and then to try and be bought off. So there, I think, was certainly, perverse is the word, a perverse incentive in place in the central state process. The second was that the state was very much underpinned by a set of regional actors. So it's the classic resource curse in some ways, that Libya's extraordinarily oil wealth meant that for a series of actors both in the region and beyond in the Gulf, having Libya's allegiance was important. And it was very much a decision of the transitional process, which was sponsored by international actors, that they would keep the petroleum dollars flowing to the central state and their distribution, the prerogative of the central state. So it set up a winner-takes-all dynamic. You know, the controlling group that managed to secure power in the post-transition period essentially controlled in absolute all of Libya's resources. The oil economy is worth 80% of Libya's export value, and it's billions. So we had a series of proxy interests, the Turks, the Russians, and others, all in there to make sure that they had some sway over this hydrocarbon giant in the world's energy economy. And there again, it was played through militia groups who had to prove their ability to influence, and they proved their ability to influence by being disruptive. So again, we had a second element in the post-conflict dynamic where the goal was disruption rather than consolidation. And then finally, we studied in great detail illicit trafficking. And illicit trafficking took a slightly different pattern. in that it became the alternative for the groups marginalized from the central state. So whereas a lot of focus was on the coastal economies, down in the southern borders, groups who had historically always been involved in cross-border trade across the Sahara now found illicit trafficking to be a very positive and dynamic resource flow that allowed them to have a valid voice in the transition. Again, it was by being difficult, by engaging in illicit acts, they sought political influence. And human smuggling became the top of the pyramid. So we talked earlier about how there was a hierarchy of illicit economies. Human smuggling became the top of that pyramid by accident. I mean, this was really a confluence of circumstances where the war in Syria and the growing displacement intersected with a local control group in the Horn of Africa. So it's partly serendipity of the unfortunate nature that illicit trafficking in and the movement of human beings became so influential in Libya's transition.
So is there a way to stop human trafficking or smuggling? Let's head southwest through the perilous Sahara Desert and back to Niger, a hub for departing migrants. Smuggling and trafficking are huge operations here, and according to UNHCR and IOM on the ground, we still don't know enough about their full impact. What we learn about their experiences comes from speaking to its victims. A new appeal has been launched for more time and investment on the ground. Najet Bilgashem is the senior policy officer for UNHCR, based in Geneva.
So, in terms of activities, there's a number of them. There's the opening of an office in Agadez, where IOM is already present. There's an increase of monitors that we plan to dispatch along the main routes, and obviously also where possible, because there also are security concerns in Niger, making it difficult for us to deploy throughout the country and along the borders. There's a referral system that we have put in place jointly with IOM and the government, which is aimed at assessing what the needs are of the people on the move, and trigger the required assistance services that they may need. So, with a clear definition of roles and responsibilities between IOM and UNHCR. There's an information campaign that we plan to also have, that will build upon what already exists. And there will be also a scale-up of a potential for solutions, because for certain people, the option of not moving forward across Libya, but then remaining in Niger may not be the best option, and for which we would be scaling up the scope for resettlement and other type of solutions.
But is it achievable?
One needs to have a comprehensive approach to the problem, and please note that Niger is a transit country. There are other countries that migrants and refugees on the move are crossing ahead of Niger, like Burkina Faso, Mali, Chad. So the comprehensive approach would mean that one needs to have a broader scope of the issue outside of Niger. But then within Niger, the broader approach would entail not only development activities, but also solutions, life saving, and then it's commonly said that that those that are behind the trafficking rings are making a lot of money out of this intra-bracket business. And maybe if you only approach the issue from a developmental aspect, which is required, may not be sufficient, because if you get so much out of this business and then you offer, you know, a basic livelihood, one may not be interested in it, and then just just continue business as usual. This is one. And then second, there are also very serious security concerns with regard to Niger and this part of the country that is prone to people smuggling and trafficking, that if their business is you know is curbed, then that may well turn into a full-fledged insecurity for part of the country. So it's very delicate. It must be approached from all aspects, including security, including, you know, in terms of right communication with the with all communities concerned on the ground.
So human trafficking is an endemic problem, a financially lucrative industry grown out of exploitation and force. Libya's instability makes it a great way to survive, and for some ambitious groups, a tool to influence the country's future. The international community sees this. It recognizes Niger as a major funnel to Libya for refugees and migrants from neighboring states. And their response? We still don't know enough about the problem. More developmental assistance and better monitoring is coming, but the desired outcome is a long way off. Next month charts 3 years since MOAS first took to the seas to save lives. To celebrate, the podcast is talking to fellow civil society organizations in Malta. We'll explore their work with people who experience forced migration and gather up the lessons learned. Until then, you can follow us on our social media. Check out our latest updates on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Audioboom. Or you can support our rescue missions by giving whatever you can to help save lives at sea. And don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe for more podcasts from us. From all of us here at MOAS, goodbye.